Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
Today on Virginia Conversations, a visit with U.S. Senator Tim Kaine. I'm Maylily Lee. Thanks for joining us. Virginia's senator has been on the job now for 17 months. He currently serves on the Armed Forces, Foreign Relations, and Budget Committees. He's also chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on Near East and South and Central Asian Affairs. Senator Kaine, welcome back to Virginia Conversations.
Maylily, it's great to be here. Thanks.
I remember when you were in your first elected office as a Richmond City Councilman. City Council was a circus. Then you became mayor and you stood out as the gentleman. I have to wonder if you had a calculated plan back then, that you had the whole thing planned out from state senate to lieutenant governor to governor.
Maylily, my political career is a proof of John Lennon's maxim, life is what happens when your plans fall through. So I didn't ever intend to go into politics, but for a variety of reasons, kind of got mad at the Richmond City Council and ran and served. And after my fourth election, so two terms as city council, two terms as mayor, I announced that I wasn't going to run for a fifth term. And I was then in a supporting mode. I was supporting Emily Couric's candidacy for lieutenant governor at that point. As you all know, I mean, Emily, who would have been the first woman governor of Virginia, I'm confident of that, had to pull out of that race because of her health, sadly. And so I had sort of closed a chapter in politics, but it reopened by coincidence, sad coincidence in that instance. I got back in, ran for lieutenant governor and governor, and I really felt comfortable at the end of my time as governor that I was done in politics, at least in terms of my own name being on a ballot or a yard sign or bumper sticker. So President Obama asked if I would chair the Democratic National Committee, and I was glad to do that. But that was a short-term thing, and I was likely going to be in higher education or in the nonprofit world. But Jim Webb's retirement was another big surprise. And so my political career has been sort of a surprising decision to run, a tragedy that then enabled me to run for state office, a surprise retirement that enabled me to run for federal office. And I think, you know, that's kind of some of the advice that I give to my kids is you ought to make plans. It's good to make plans. But also all kinds of things happen in life and you have to be open to the inspiration of the moment and be willing to adjust. So I've now been in 20 years. My election to Richmond City Council you were talking about was in May of 1994. That was 20 years ago. But I don't think I would have predicted that. But I get up every day really excited about the opportunity I have to do something good. Some days I meet that criteria, and other days I say I didn't really do anything great today, but I can always try harder tomorrow.
There's this recognition, too. I remember you mentioning a man at Graves Mountain Lodge who came up to you.
I was hiking at Graves Mountain Lodge with some law school friends. I brought him to Virginia to show off the Shenandoah National Park, and this was just two weekends ago. And a guy came up to me at a store and said, "You used to be lieutenant governor." And not "you used to be governor," not "you're a U.S. senator." "You used to be lieutenant governor." And I just looked at him. I said, "You're absolutely right. I did used to be lieutenant governor." And in Richmond, people all the time say, "Don't you do the weather?" Because, you know, I know this is a statewide audience, but we have a Richmond weather guy named John Bernier, and he and I look a lot alike. So it's good to be humbled and be reminded that, you know, I mean, hey, politics ain't everything.
That's great, though, to know that John Bernier can stand in for you if you can't make it next time.
I do not want to operate in front of the green screen that he has to. That would be beyond me.
You spent over 18 years, more than 18 years in public office on this side of the Beltway. So
yeah.
What's political life like inside the Beltway?
It's very different in a lot of ways. So, you know, maybe the first thing that's different is in being a mayor and governor, you're kind of an executive. The mayoral powers were not strong powers when I was mayor, but still you're kind of an executive. You're at the top of a pyramid, whatever size that pyramid is. Then you go to the Senate, and I was 95th in seniority out of 100 when I walked in the door, and it's a seniority-driven place. So you're not at the top of a pyramid. They kind of have a hazing ritual that goes on for four or five terms or so, I hear. So you're not an executive, but the key to happiness in the Senate is to try to be an expert. So it's not an executive job. It's an expertise job. And I focus on armed services. I focus on foreign relations. I focus on budget, plus one educational issue, career and technical education. And I just try to dig into those issues. The thing that has been discouraging about it is, you know, Congress has a low reputation, low approval ratings. And from the outside, I would have assumed that was because of hyperpartisanship. That's part of it. But what I actually find is that some of the dysfunction in Congress is not partisanship. It's poor communication skills. People don't listen to each other. And it's not just because of partisanship. It's, you know, everybody's racing in after they've spent the weekend in their district racing in. They're going to race through the week and we have really long work days and they race out. You can't get good work done in a group environment if you don't listen to others. You know, listening to somebody on the other side of the aisle enables you to find, well, we disagree 80% of the time, but here's some issues that we agree on. Not enough of the kind of basic communication and listening is done. And that's one of the reasons why Congress has a hard time getting work done. House and Senate members hardly spend any time together. In Virginia, we're rare in that we have a Virginia lunch every month with the House and Senate members. Most states don't do that.
Bipartisan.
Most states don't do it. And aside from that interaction with the Virginia guys, if you don't explicitly force yourself to, you would have zero interaction with House members. And so there's some communication and, you know, need to listen to each other and dialogue more, things that have been frustrating my first year and a half. But I don't have any complaints. I think I have the ability, at least in my own actions, to try to break some of those communication barriers down.
I think people crave real dialogue and we could all listen better. I wonder if you've had a moment when you listened to the other side with a big O and a big S and actually changed your mind based on what you were hearing.
So that's kind of a question where I should just give you the Rorschach, whatever just comes to my mind. So the answer is yes, a number of times. But the one that comes to mind, frankly, is a bill that I worked on with Eric Cantor that we got passed dealing with pediatric research. We passed immigration reform in the Senate a year ago, very important bill, and the House hadn't done anything on it. And I've been critical of the House for that. We passed some other bills, ending employment discrimination against LGBT Americans. House hadn't done anything with it. So I've been complaining about that. Eric Cantor brought me a House bill that they had passed dealing with pediatric cancer research. I'm not on the Health Committee. I have my own bills that I'm working on. But it was a compelling bill, and it was a bill that was inspired by a Virginia young lady, and Eric and I worked to get it passed. But once we got it passed, and then we had a signing ceremony in President Obama's office in March, the Gabriella Miller bill, I suddenly realized, well, I've been griping about the House guys not acting on the bills that we send over. I wonder how many bills they passed that we don't do anything on. So I had my staff pull all the House bills that they passed that we're not doing anything on. Now, some are kind of just political, the 50th repeal of Obamacare. Some are intensely local things that might matter to a representative from the San Joaquin Valley of California that wouldn't be a bill that I would champion. But it turns out there's a lot of good House bills that pass that come to the Senate and nobody ever does anything with them only because we're senators. We have our own priorities. So might be a good bill, but I'm not interested in that. I got my own thing I'm working on. So what I've started to do, and I've also shared this with another senator, Angus King of Maine, an independent, is, hey, let's look at the House bills. Every time a House bill comes over, let's look at it. And if it looks like it's a good one, let's call the sponsor on the House side and say, hey, guess what? I'm not stealing your bill and introducing it as the Tim Kaine bill. I want to get your bill passed in the Senate. And when we do this, the House members are like stunned, like, well, this never happens. I mean, we don't ever get a call unprompted from somebody in the Senate saying, I want to get your bill passed. But the great thing about it, May Lilly, is if I took that exact bill and then I tried to get it passed in the Senate, it would get changed a little bit along the way. And if it passed, it would go over to the House and then they'd have to decide if they liked the change or didn't. It would take some time. But if I work and get a House bill passed, it doesn't go back to the House. It goes to the president's desk for signature, and you end up in the Oval Office having a bill signing a couple weeks later. So what I realize, it's a long story, though, is that it's not just the Senate that's frustrated by the House not passing our immigration reform bill. They have frustrations too. And part of building more cooperation is listening to that frustration that they have and then seeing if we can break it down. And look, I'm not just a complete altruist about this. I feel like if I get a bill passed and I need to get it through the House, the more of this I do, the more likely I'll be to be successful on the priorities that are my top priorities.
We've seen people like Mitt Romney who changed his mind on some issues. And people accused him of being wishy-washy and, you know, that's not political.
Got to change your mind on issues.
Got to grow, got to learn. And now we're going to be opening up the phones for questions later. I'm sure people have questions for you about the debacle of the VA hospitals. Perhaps that will come later.
Yep.
But first, I'm interested in another issue our $17 trillion national debt.
Yep.
How can Congress live with that? And by the way, in terms of bills and laws, you reference this. This Congress is the least productive of any Congress in U.S. history. Why are lawmakers not making this massive debt the most important priority now?
Well, so first, I don't think the debt should be the most important priority. I think there are other priorities that are more important. Here's why I say it. $17 trillion is a lot of money, but debt is a percentage of GDP is what the real measure, frankly, if you're trying to manage debt. When I was governor, we didn't have a fixed dollar number. We won't have more than X dollars worth of debt. We had ratios. What's the percentage of debt service to the total budget? What's the total amount of debt compared to the state GDP? And we have the same at the federal level. $17 trillion is a big number, but we have a massive economy and a massive budget. And right now, the publicly held portion of our debt is about 75% to 80% of GDP. A nation like Japan, it's like 230% of GDP. Most economists would say our debt to GDP is too high, but it's too high by a couple of percentage points. And frankly, since I came to the Senate, the annual deficits have been dramatically dropping. So we're getting close to the ratio that is frankly an acceptable ratio. But here's the problem. In 10 years, it starts to go back up significantly again because of we healthy baby boomers are living longer. I'm a baby boomer. You're younger than me. But we're living longer and, you know, the life expectancy keeps adding. And so our debt to GDP is actually getting in a pretty good place right now. Deficits are coming down. We passed the first two-year budget deal in the history of the United States in my first year in the Senate. And we did it because, frankly, the government shutdown was so stupid that we said, look, we need to do something to show people we'll give you some certainty. So we are dealing, I think, with the debt properly on the short term, but we're still not dealing with it in the best way in the long term. We still have to find a comprehensive budget deal that would do two things that are hard to do, that would reform some of the Medicare Social Security entitlement programs and reform them not because they're bad, but reform them because with everybody living longer, the sort of actuarial soundness of these programs has to be continually improved. But secondly, we have to reform our tax code. We give out way too much in the tax code through the deductions, credits, loopholes, tax expenditures. And the tax code, it's now, 27 years after the last major tax reform. It's riddled with like Swiss cheese of holes that are these special interest deductions and loopholes. And we've got to reform those. And if we can make some credible savings over time in these entitlement programs, and there's a number of them of straightforward ways to do it, and we can do some tax reform to eliminate or at least close down some of these loopholes, we're going to be fine fiscally. But we have to be willing to make that deal. And I'm glad to be on the budget committee and along with Mark Warner, who's made this his real passion, be preaching this every day.
Obamacare.
Yep.
It seemed like a good idea at first, but it became such a travesty that even the president sought outside help. If you have ideas on how to improve the system, let me know, he would say. So how would you fix Obamacare?
Well, first, got to be willing to fix it. But let me start off with the good. Through the Affordable Care Act, more than 10 million, it's about 12 million now, and the number grows every day, Americans have health insurance, either because they're youngsters who can now stay on family policies till they're 26, they have gotten insurance through exchanges created because of the Affordable Care Act, or they live in states where Medicaid has been expanded. That number, 12 million, to put it into context, it's bigger than the combined population of 10 states, and it's growing every day. Americans like my own family, we have protection against pre-existing conditions. We can't be blocked from insurance because of that. And we have had the experience of having insurance companies not want to write insurance for every member of my family because of pre-existing conditions. They can't do it anymore. Seniors are getting prescription drugs cheaper, getting free preventive care. Women can't be discriminated against in insurance. Starting next year, there will be mental health parity in insurance program policy, so mental health services can't be sort of dissed. So there's a lot of good, and we got to protect the good. And I will fight against repeal of this to my last breath. However, there are important changes to be made. So I've already been part of about four reform bills, one to create a what's called a copper plan, which is even a more stripped down plan that could be more affordable for families. It would have basic protections, but it might have higher copays and higher deductibles so that the monthly premium is more affordable. I've supported bipartisan legislation to expand the small business tax credit so that it can be used by more businesses. I've supported some legislation to fix how subsidies can be offered to help people who are buying family insurance policies rather than just individual insurance policies. And I think what we have to be willing to do, May Lilly, is look at everything about the ACA, but more broadly, not just the ACA, healthcare generally. Remember, we're spending 18% of our GDP on healthcare, where the next nation, Switzerland, is only spending 11%. If we even got halfway down to where Switzerland was, it would take care of the deficit virtually overnight. I mean, we would dramatically reduce the deficit. So we have to embrace other cost-saving strategies, and I continue to look for opportunities with my colleagues to do it.
We're talking with Senator Tim Kaine. You're chairman of the Subcommittee on Near Eastern and South and Central Asian Affairs, as we mentioned. And this week in the news, we see the letter from Senator Black thanking President Assad of Syria on Facebook, no less.
Yeah.
And this is a war criminal. What an interesting news splash.
Yeah, well, I was stunned by it. I mean, Bashar al-Assad is a war criminal who is committing some of the grossest human rights abuses since World War II. Now, that doesn't mean that he might not be helping a group here or helping a group there. But to the extent that he doesn't treat some group with, you know, inhumane ferocity, that's no reason to thank him.
Mm-hmm. Except that the senator is saying if we had a choice between al-Qaeda and President Assad, we'll take Assad.
Yeah, but that's a false choice. The assertion that the Syrian opposition is just all al-Qaeda is wrong. I've met a lot with Syrian opposition leaders, and there's a significant, what we would call kind of a moderate Syrian opposition. That's been the history of that country. It's been more secular and moderate, and it's those people who started to protest against Assad's leadership. Now, it is the case that there's some al-Qaeda elements trying to topple Assad for reasons as well. But that's no reason to just say, well, I guess we have to accept Assad because he's better than the alternative. There's a much better alternative for the Syrian people than either al-Qaeda or Bashar al-Assad. And what that alternative involves is a couple of things. The United States has been deeply involved in the effort to destroy the Syrian chemical weapons stockpile. It's one of the biggest in the world. And while there's been some starts and stops, we've destroyed massive amounts of chemical weapons, and that work will proceed apace, and we'll get there. Second, the U.S. is the largest provider of humanitarian aid in the world to Syrian refugees. Now, I've visited with Syrian refugees in my committee chairmanship role in Lebanon, in Turkey, and in Jordan, and the U.S. is doing massive work. However, the weakness is this, May Lilly. Most of the aid is going to refugees who fled outside the country. There's still just horrible human rights and humanitarian need inside the country. And what we need to do, and the UN Security Council finally passed a resolution to do this in February, because Russia's been vetoing every human rights resolution, but they, in the middle of the Winter Olympics, I guess they felt like they couldn't veto it. We need to deliver humanitarian aid across the border into Syria, together with other nations and with the UN. And that's sort of the next step forward. But nobody should be an apologist for Bashar al-Assad. Nobody should be an apologist for atrocities committed by others. This is a horrible situation, and we've got to work to improve it.
That's Senator Tim Kaine, and we'll continue our conversation with him on this program. You're listening to Virginia Conversations. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. And welcome back. Today, we're pleased to have with us Virginia's Senator Tim Kaine. We're also joined by two distinguished professors of political science, Robert Roberts of JMU and Harry Wilson of Roanoke College. Robert Roberts, I'm going to start with you. I know that we were talking about a question for the senator.
Yeah, we've seen this Veterans Administration scandal erupt, and this is not new. We've seen the same criticism Veterans Administration for decades. Is it time to reconsider the entire system of veterans hospitals with the possibility of simply turning the system over to the private or nonprofit sector?
Dr. Roberts, we've got to make some fundamental changes, and you're right. Complaints about the VA you know, a paper record system when they should have an electronic record system, backlogs in veterans who are trying to get VA benefits determinations, backlog in trying to get treatment, the current massive problem. These are not new, but and we need dramatic change to fix them. I don't think the dramatic change is going to involve a complete sort of privatization model because I think these VA hospitals, most would agree that the quality of care that they provide is pretty good. There's some exceptions, but as I talk to veterans, they make that point over and over. Quality of care is good, but access to care is a challenge. It's one thing if you live in Richmond and you live near the McGuire VA or you live in Salem and you're near the VA hospital there. If you live far away from a VA hospital, then it does become much more problematic. So one reform that I think we should be open to is allowing more and more veterans the ability to access medical care through local healthcare providers using VA benefits to do so. And so a system that would, you know, allow them to go to local physicians and then have those, you know, basically covered by a veteran's benefit. This happens already to some degree. There are VA clinics out in communities around the Commonwealth and country. But there might be more way to integrate the private sector health delivery model into the VA benefit kind of system in ways that would enable people to get access nearer their home more promptly.
Thanks so much, Robert Roberts of JMU. And Matt from Virginia Beach actually has a dovetail on that issue.
Great.
Hi, Matt. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, good morning. I thank you. And Mr. Kane, thank you so much for taking time to answer these questions.
Absolutely, Matt.
I don't understand the whole scheme of health care, but when I pull back and I look at the proposition from the government to administer the health care program, and it all sounds good on paper, but has anybody possibly looked at it and said, boy, if we can't run a good VA system like the caller just suggested and we're seeing in the news and we're having problems with the Postal Service and the IRS and a lot of other government agencies with overpayments and underpayments and just efficiencies, if we can't run the VA, is that not sort of a snapshot of what we might anticipate with overall health care 5-10 years down the line when I think a lot of the private stuff goes away just based on how things are headed? It seems I run a small business, and I don't really think that the anticipated result of this new Affordable Care Act is anything less than a single-payer system based on what I've seen with our rates going just through the roof. I don't think that businesses are going to be able to afford to pay it, and I think most businesses are going to just opt to pay the penalty and put everybody on the government exchange.
Okay. Thanks, Matt.
Yeah, so that's a broad question. Look, are there problems at the post office? Are there problems at the VA? Sure there are, but I don't think the fact that there are problems with human institutions means that, well, you know, we shouldn't do it that way or government can't provide it. There are problems with private institutions. You know, you can open the headlines every day and see a GM recall or something like that. So there's going to be problems, there's going to be scandals, there're going to be challenges. We're imperfect human beings, and when we combine into organizations, the organizations are going to be imperfect. But I think that I lived for a while in Central America, and I've traveled in some other countries, and I wouldn't trade the system we have for other systems. We just have to be rigorous in try to reform. One thing, Matt, that I don't like about politics, I certainly saw this about the Affordable Care Act when I went into the Senate first, is a lot of the Democrats who'd voted for the Affordable Care Act said, well, we can't ever change or reform it because that would suggest it wasn't perfect. Well, I'll tell you what, it ain't perfect and nothing's perfect. And Republicans were saying we can't try to reform it and make it better. We can only repeal or nothing. So nobody was willing to talk meaningful reforms. Everybody was kind of stuck in the extreme corners. We all have to be just wake up every day with reform on our mind, whether it's about the Affordable Care Act, the VA, the post office, or anything else. We've got to be willing to reform because the needs of tomorrow aren't the same as the needs of yesterday. And so we can't have, you know, we can't be too attached to the way it was done. We got to be willing to shake things up.
And now back to Harry Wilson of Roanoke College.
Good morning, Senator.
Hey, Harry.
With the recent shooting in Santa Barbara, gun control is back in the news. What do you think the prospects are for tougher gun laws in Congress? What specifically would you support? And how do you think those restrictions would help prevent such tragedies?
Harry, you've asked the question the right way, help prevent such tragedies. We will not prevent violence, and we will not prevent gun violence. There's no way to eliminate it. But the experience of other nations and other communities shows, even Virginia's own experience, that you can reduce the likelihood. You can help prevent these kinds of tragedies. A little over a year ago, in April of 2013, I cast two votes in the Senate for what I would consider basic, reasonable rules of the road about gun use. And one bill I supported was a universal background record check system so that folks couldn't buy weapons if they were felons or they were under a domestic violence protective order or they had been adjudicated mentally ill and dangerous. Whatever the circumstances of the sale, there would need to be a background record check to enforce the existing laws about who can and can't have weapons. We fell short on that vote. It was one of my two most disappointing days in the Senate because I thought, here's a common sense bill. And we learned after the shooting at Virginia Tech that it was a weakness in our background record check system that allowed Sung Wee Cho to purchase those weapons that wreaked so much carnage back in 2007 in Blacksburg. So I've supported that, and I believe we will eventually get there, and I hope it's before there are too many more tragedies. The second thing I supported on a vote we cast that day was limitation on the size of ammunition magazines. And I believe the bill that we voted on was to limit ammunition magazines to less than 12. If in a number of these shootings, if the individuals had had smaller magazines, it would have given law enforcement or even bystanders the ability to stop these tragedies while they were occurring as somebody stopped to reload weapons. And I don't think there's a need. And I think completely consistent with the Second Amendment, you can put these kinds of regulations in place. In fact, the Supreme Court has said that very plainly. So your question was, what's it going to take? You know, we fell just a little bit short on the background record check bill in April of 2013. I hope people have watched and grieved as these instances have happened since. And I think eventually it's going to be these tragedies, but also the overwhelming support of the American public. NRA members support background record checks. So it's going to be the support of the voters that will get us there. And I just hope it's sooner rather than later.
We go to Fredericksburg for this call from Scott. Good morning.
Good morning, Senator. How you doing?
Hey, Scott.
So I'm a veteran, and I'm currently in the Virginia National Guard. I've done tours in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Good for
you. Really appreciated all the work that Senator Webb did with the post 9/11 GI Bill and all
the GI Bill, sure.
So I have a question though regarding Title 32 orders and Title 10 orders.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is Title 10 is generally federal military orders, and Title 32 are generally state level.
You bet.
So the 9/11 GI Bill is a percentage based system. So the more active duty time you get, the closer you get to your 100% benefit.
Right.
Now, there's a lot of us that have done, you know, extended additional duty tours in the National Guard system on Title 32, and that doesn't qualify us to build up that percentage, even though it was, you know, years of active duty time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm wondering if this is a cost-saving measure or if people just don't understand the difference. And we really saw this when we had the furloughs last year. They passed a ruling saying that, you know, anybody that's military continue working and, you know, all that. Well, all the Title 32 full-time guys were, you know, out of work for over a month.
Yep. Thanks so much for that question.
Hey, Scott, no, I think that's a fantastic question. And just for listeners, if folks are not, you know, completely familiar with these issues, I mean, one of the great things about our nation's military is this use of Guard and Reserve. And the Virginia Guard, just using the Virginia Guard as an example, and Scott's a member of it, has this double mission where kind of under normal circumstances they are used for state missions. I would call out the National Guard frequently for weather emergencies, fighting forest fires, flood relief, helping solve transportation jams usually caused by weather emergencies, and they would perform admirably. But the president has the ability to activate the Guard in each state to deploy them in times usually of significant military operations. So a lot of our Virginia Guard men and women have deployed repeatedly in the last 13 years to Iraq and Afghanistan and have done amazing, amazing work. I think we've probably used used the Guard of Virginia and other states in a different way in the last 13 years than maybe had been planned. We've changed the Guard, May Lilly and Scott, from a kind of a reserve force to a really operations tempo force. And so some of the benefit decisions about what Guard members would get were really based on an earlier model of the Guard was a reserve force. We're using the Guard for operations tempo activities now, and we probably have to rethink what some of these benefits are. There will be a cost component to it. But I can tell you this, as we're looking at a whole series of questions about the military going forward, trying to take advantage of the fact that our guardsmen and women have had these op-tempo experiences and they've had some strong training and they've performed well, and not letting the Guard just go back to the reserve force, but continue to view the Guard as a tremendous asset for operations, I think it's going to change thinking about the structure of the Guard and how the Guard integrates in within the rest of the military. For example, on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, it wasn't until recently that the head of the Guard was part of the Joint Chiefs. We just had chiefs for each of the service branches, but not of the Guard. But we've added the head of the Guard to the Joint Chiefs because of a recognition that we're using the Guard in new ways. And that probably will require that we look at some of these benefit-type rules that were from an earlier day, that we look at them in a new way as well.
Here's a city that's home to many servicemen and women, Norfolk. Good morning, David. How are you?
Hey, good, thanks. How you doing, Tim? It's David, hey, David. Calling from Norfolk.
Yeah, hey, David.
It's Davey, your nephew.
Oh, cousin, my nephew Davey. This is my nephew Davey, who's a naval intelligence officer. I've got a 24-year-old nephew who's a naval intelligence officer and a 24-year-old son who is a – Davey, he just got bumped to first lieutenant about a week ago.
Someone hand me the manual on nepotism on this show.
Today too.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So what's your question? You can ask me a tough one since you're a family
I'm going to go get coffee.
Yeah.
I have a question about the pivot to Southeast Asia, which seemed like a great sensible thing to do when Obama came into office early on, moving from a place where we're tired of engaging in conflicts to a place where we had allies that were eager for support and a very clear problem to solve. However, you know, with the crises in the Middle East in 2011, and this applies specifically to your chairmanship of the subcommittee, do you think that we are devoting enough resources, military or otherwise, solving issues in the Middle Eastern region? And ultimately, the second part of my question is, what is our strategic vision for that region, which is something that I find hard to see through how we've reacted to it in the last few years.
Sure.
Thanks, Davey.
Yeah, Davey's a great, fantastic young naval officer. So when the president announced early in his presidency that we were going to do a pivot to Asia, I wouldn't have done that because the rationale I completely get. And we're definitely taking some things that show it. But if you say we're pivoting to Asia, everybody else in the world says, oh, wait, we're less important. And then they start to get nervous. And even in Asia, nations in Asia are like, huh, why are they pivoting our way? They start to get nervous. And I think the idea is in this world, it's the force needs to be flexible force, not fixed force. You've got to be able to have force that you can deploy, whether it's in the west or the east or the north or the south. And so I didn't like that pivot to Asia. But certainly what the president was saying is we're drawn down out of two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that extra materiel and focus is going to go elsewhere. And he rightly, you know, looks that the growing population, the population center in the world is going to be the Asian population going forward. And we are doing a number of things like negotiating a pretty comprehensive trade deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, with a number of nations on the Pacific Rim. So there's some work going on there. But Davey's question is, okay, well, where does that leave the Middle East? Are we really pivoting out of the Middle East? What's the strategic vision for the Middle East? I would say this, that the vision in the Middle East is basically got a couple of components, but we also have to face some realities. And here's one. We are not as dependent upon Middle Eastern oil as we used to be. A lot of what was driving American Middle Eastern policy was an intense dependence upon oil being shipped out of the Gulf states. And America's own energy revolution, which is a great thing, is making us less dependent on the Middle East. And so that is creating anxiety there, but it's anxiety that is natural. But it's good that we're having our own energy sources. I like being less dependent on the Middle East. What we need to do in the Middle East is first continue to partner with strong allies, Israel, Gulf state nations, Jordan, nations like Morocco and North Africa that have interesting both economic and cultural traditions. They may not do things exactly like we do them, but it's important that we maintain the partnerships. We need to maintain this the partnership in Afghanistan as they are having this presidential election as we in combat operations. So working with existing partnerships to keep them strong is important. Dramatic increases in trade and foreign direct investment. We do a great job diplomatically. We do a better job diplomatically if we are more deeply engaged economically. Third thing we do is we be aggressively diplomatic. I think during the 2000 and 2010 decade, we often underused diplomacy as a foreign policy tool. But we're deeply involved in diplomatic efforts in Syria. We're deeply involved in discussions with Iran over the necessary end to their nuclear program, which, if they end it, will help Iran reintegrate back into the community of nations. That could be a very positive thing. We're deeply involved in discussions between Israel and Palestine about peace there. And all of these negotiations are tough, and none of them are producing like a big victory today. We got to keep at the table on them. But aggressive diplomacy in the Middle East, we're probably more aggressive diplomatically in the Middle East now than we've been for a very long time.
Let's go back to the phones. This call from Newport News. Let's see if any more of your relatives are calling. Angela, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. No,
absolutely, Angela.
No relation. I have another question in terms of the VA. Today's Daily Press has a headline, Virginians Call for Shinseki to Quit.
Yep.
And one of the things that I don't understand is, and I know that most of this has come to light because of the VA in Phoenix.
Yes.
And the paper says 1,700 veterans were at risk for not receiving care.
Yes.
And I know that Senator McCain has called for Shinseki's resignation. And my question is, was Senator McCain at all aware that there were any problems? Because some of us know to call our representatives and senators when there are problems.
Right. Thanks,
and
Angela.
So my question is, if this could be hidden from Senator McCain, how much of this was hidden for Shinseki? And sort of asking why you've called for his resignation.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Thank you.
So first, General Shinseki has had a remarkable public service career in the military, and he's done a number of positive things in the VA. But I did yesterday regrettably come to the conclusion that the president needs to replace the leadership. And Angela, I'll tell you why. It's less about what happened yesterday than about what needs to happen tomorrow. I've learned as a mayor and governor, when you're in an organization like this, and there's a big problem that has to be fixed, and I think we would all agree that this VA problem is a big problem, a scandalous problem. It has to be fixed. You have to have the confidence in the leadership that they can fix it. So I don't know whether this problem can be laid at General Shinseki's feet as if it was his fault. I'm not making that claim. But what I do know is this: the VA has been telling Congress for some time that they are working on and improving waiting times for veterans, whether it's for approval of VA benefits or access to service. They've been telling us we're working on it and it's getting better. And when they say that and then evidence comes out that, no, it's still horribly bad and you have to improve it, you got to have somebody solving the problem that you have confidence in. And I don't think the American public and especially veterans could have confidence in current leadership to solve it.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations. We'll be back.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Virginia Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
Welcome back to Virginia Conversations. I'm May Lily Lee. We're joined by Senator Tim Kaine. And also joining us are Harry Wilson, Professor and Director for Institute for Policy and Opinion Research at Roanoke College, and Robert Roberts, Professor of Political Science at James Madison University. You know, Senator Kaine, I know that this is an important measure for you. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Career and Technical Scholars Program.
Yes. Thanks, May Lily. Well, one of the areas of my great passion is education. But when I got to the Senate, I didn't get put on the Education Committee, which is a little disappointing. But I have great committees, so I really can't complain. But what I decided to do is let me pick an educational issue where there's not currently a champion in the Senate. And even though I'm not on the committee, focus my energies there. And what I picked was career and technical education. My dad ran an ironworking and welding shop, and I grew up working in my dad's shop. I ran a vocational school in Honduras for a year in 1980 and 81, teaching kids to be carpenters and welders. and I'm passionate about career and technical education, and that the right answer for every student after they finish high school is not going to the four-year college. For many, you know, learning to be a welder, learning to be a Cisco systems administrator, getting on the code.org and learning to be a computer coder, there's wonderful paths to careers that involve career and technical training. So Senator Rob Portman of Ohio, Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, and me formed a Career and Technical Education Caucus. And last week, we wrote a letter to the president, and we made a suggestion I'm really excited about. 50 years ago, President Johnson, by executive order, started something called the Presidential Scholars, celebrating a high school boy and girl in each state every year who were exemplary high school students. Now, these tend to be kids who are, you know, going off to the Ivy League schools or something, and then they come to Washington for a week and they're celebrated for their academic achievements. We wrote a letter to President Obama saying, why don't you, by executive order, just like LBJ did 50 years ago, start the President's Career and Technical Scholars and honor a boy and girl in each state every year, high schooler, who have done exemplary work in career and technical fields while in high school. It might be EMT studies, or it might be computer coding, or it might be auto mechanics or welding or ironworking. But let's say that career and technical education is every bit as important. Excellence there is every bit as important as excellence on, you know, the core academic courses that are tested on the SAT exam or the standards of learning. We wrote the letter to the president because of the 50th anniversary, but also because he's about to give a graduation speech at a technical high school in Massachusetts on the 11th of June. And I know when I gave speeches like that, I always wanted to have something to announce. And so we felt like, why don't we encourage the president to do it? Because there's so much more. There's a lot of good work going on in career and technical fields. I'm going to a new workforce training center that the Ironworkers Union is opening south of Richmond a week from Saturday. And the Newport News apprenticeship program in Hampton Roads is fantastic. But there's much more we can do. And part of doing more is shining the spotlight on it and saying career and technical education is really important.
On that subject, let's turn to Philip. He has a question somewhat related. Philip, where are you from?
Amherst County.
Hey, Phil.
Yes, Senator Kane, good morning, and thank you very much for being available today.
Absolutely.
I think you've actually answered the question I have. I will quickly run that question through.
Great.
And I think we'll agree. You've answered it very well. But would you please comment more specifically on our need to work for the future and our energy security? My question was, how would you emphasize and support ways that we can take advantage of job creation within solar and wind power for our energy security? So you can see how you've already responded to a major part of that.
Yeah, well, let me now really focus it on the issue of our energy economy, because, you know, it's been a great success story in the United States, our energy innovation. And may Lily, I'll say, we've been doing a lot of good things, often in spite of federal policy, rather than because of federal policy. But nevertheless, the advances in the ability to find more natural gas at a less expensive rate have been dramatic, and they have lessened our reliance on overseas energy, increasing our security, as Philip suggests. Wind and solar are coming on strong. You know, 35% of the power added to the United States power production grid since 2007 has been wind power. 35%. Solar is dramatically dropping. So what we're seeing is a huge expansion of low and no carbon energy, which is incredibly important because it's reliable, because it helps us deal with climate change issues, which I'm very concerned about. But also in the traditional energy spaces, natural gas, coal, there's opportunities to do traditional energy cleaner tomorrow than we're doing it today, which would be good for the environment and good for the economy as well. So we have to put the right, you know, incentives in place, and some of that involves tax incentives, and the incentives need to be steady, not just one year at a time, and then everybody worries about whether they'll expire or not. But we also have to train a workforce for these jobs. Labor organizations are deeply involved in it. Community colleges are deeply involved in it. We can do more career and technical education in the high schools to get students prepared for these energy jobs of tomorrow. Department of Energy just approved a big wind project off the coast in Virginia that Dominion is going to be doing. Virginia has some real opportunities for wind power. But it's great. They're great jobs. It's domestic manufacturing, and it's manufacturing in an important area where if we're leaders, it will help the environment and help our economy at the same time.
I want to go back to you, Robert Roberts at JMU. You have any follow-up on the VA discussion that you started?
No, it's interesting in terms of we've looked at the VA, the system, for a long, long time.
Yep.
And you said you might be open to, let's say, more contracting out and the veterans going to private providers. But we've been looking at that for a long time. And why isn't there at least an effort to look at a much broader concept that the veterans, the whole veteran system may have outlived its usefulness, that we have excellent hospitals in Virginia, excellent health care in Virginia, and if those veterans were just integrated into the existing system, it might simply be a lot more efficient than trying to get this very large bureaucracy to operate more efficiently.
So, yeah, so Dr. Roberts, your question, I mean, we have to be willing to rethink and look anew at these issues. But your question was, why haven't we looked at that more broad reform? And
right.
I'll tell you, I think the reason that we haven't is because for all the criticism of the VA, the veterans are strongly supportive of the VA system. And I think they would fight very, very hard against a reform that would basically take the VA benefits and just completely integrate them into sort of the private or nonprofit hospital and healthcare provider world. Because again, the quality of the services provided at the VA tend to get pretty high marks from veterans community and others. But the challenges tend to be around efficiency and access. So if you were to say, look, you know, just let's contemplate a system where we just kind of eliminate VA-specific institutions and provide veterans benefits that they can use in the community, I think you'd get a huge amount of pushback from veterans on that because they actually generally like the VA system when it's running well. So that's my surmise about why the bigger picture reform hasn't really been put on the table. But look, we've got to get – I think we need new leadership in the VA who are going to tackle these access problems and tackle them with a high degree of urgency. And part of that has to be, you know, being candid and honest about what the problems are and what the fixes are.
Harry Wilson, professor at Roanoke College.
Hello again. I'm going to change the topic and ask what I hope is a policy but not a political question, if that's possible, on Benghazi.
Yeah.
As you know, the House is forming the select committee and there's a lot of politics with this. Republicans saying we have to get to the bottom of this. Democrats generally arguing it's been investigated. We know what happened. I'm assuming that you're coming down on the side of the House Democrats on that. So if that's the case, could you tell us if we know what happened? I really sort of have a several-part question here. Could you tell us sort of what went wrong, where the fault lies, if you believe the fault lies anywhere, and how the initial explanations of the administration turned out to be pretty inaccurate?
Sure. No, I'm glad to tackle that, Dr. Wilson. And I'll tell you my view on this from a policy standpoint is this was a tragedy. This loss of these four American lives was a tragedy. And I think efforts to politicize it are very unseemly and wrong. And I think there have been a lot of efforts to politicize it. And the reason I say that is most of the discussion up around Congress about this is trying to affix blame rather than to fix the problem. And we got a blueprint right in front of us about how to fix the problem. There was an accountability review board that was called to analyze everything that went wrong at Benghazi in the days after this horrible event in September of 2012. The Accountability Review Board made a series of very concrete findings about what went wrong and then recommendations about how to eliminate the chance of it happening in the future. And there's just almost no discussion up on Capitol Hill about the implementation of the recommendations and about making the improvements to keep our people safer. What people want to fight about is the blame game portion when we ought to be fighting on the how do we fix it portion. Now, what I'm trying to do on that is I'm trying to keep my efforts – both on armed services and foreign relations, on the how do we fix it portion. One of the recommendations was made is that we need more Marine security guards at high-threat embassy posts, and we needed to expand the size of that program by about 1,000 people. On the Armed Services Committee, I've been fighting to get the Marines the augmentation of an additional 1,000 Marine security guards who are trained at Quantico. Second recommendation was the State Department for years has been saying that they needed to provide better security training for State Department personnel because these ambassadorial posts are often very dangerous now, but the training that was being given to them was not heavy on security training. The State Department has been looking for a training facility, and I've worked with the State Department and the administration to help them land on a facility that they're going to build at Fort Pickett down south of Richmond here in Virginia, which is accessible to the State Department folks in D.C. This was a recommendation of the Accountability Review Board. There's about 30 recommendations of the Accountability Review Board about how to fix this so that it is less likely to happen again. And I just wish the discussion in Capitol Hill was about how can we do these fixes rather than the continued effort to assign blame. I actually think the Accountability Review Board does a pretty good job of assessing blame, you know, inadequate attention to some of the security measures, an old-fashioned view of what the security challenges were that doesn't take into account new realities, inadequacy of personnel. They were hiring in-country security assistants that were poorly vetted, that were not well-trained. The security group that they had hired in Benghazi was on a work stoppage. They didn't like their pay, and so they weren't really performing well. And that in-country security that wasn't really doing their job was part of the reason that this horrible event happened. So bottom line is, I'm okay talking about Benghazi, but let's talk about how to reduce the chance of it happening again rather than just have this orgy of finger-pointing, which is so common a D.C. tradition, in which I think most people outside the Beltway look at it and they find it kind of disgusting.
Now, Ed from Lynchburg has a question relating to something that has shown up at least recently in the General Assembly. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning. Thank you, Senator Kaine.
Sure, Ed.
My question is regarding cannabis policy, and I wanted to ask your position on legalizing and regulating cannabis so that we can keep it away from our children and raise some revenue that we can use to address budget shortfalls. I understand there's a bill introduced by a conservative Republican Virginian to reschedule cannabis to Schedule II. One, would you support that and introduce a companion measure in the Senate? And additionally, do you support, Governor of Colorado has said, you know, no more people are smoking marijuana after it's been legalized. The existing people are now paying taxes. Do you support that policy in Virginia?
Great question. And the answer is no, I'm not yet a supporter of the Colorado-style legalization of cannabis in Virginia. I think Colorado will prove an interesting example, and I'm going to watch it with interest to see if it has the effect that, you know, I know the governor and some others are claiming what effect it's having early. I think it's going to take a while to determine the effect that it has, and I'm interested in that. But I am generally in favor of significant sentencing reforms to dramatically reduce sentences for nonviolent drug offenses, the rescheduling cannabis possession from a higher category crime to a lesser one generally sounds sensible to me. I think our prisons and jails are too full of nonviolent drug offenders, and I think it's smart fiscally and frankly more productive for society that we don't use jail for nonviolent possession offenses. But I'm not yet on the legalization point, because legalization, I believe, will increase usage. And we have to grapple with the question whether increased usage is a good or a bad thing for society. I'm concerned that it would not be a good thing, that it would be a bad thing, but I'm interested in the Colorado experiment. Kind of traditional federalism says let states experiment, then you can learn from the experiments, and if they work, you know, that's something I'm going to be paying attention to.
We're talking with Senator Tim Kaine. Let's go to Charlottesville for this call from Donald. Hi, Donald.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, Donald.
Just here in the last few days, Vermont became the first state in the nation to pass labeling on transgenic food, and yet when this came up for a vote in the Senate, you voted against labeling, despite 90% of the people in the nation wanting it. This looks like a vote in favor of the Grocery Manufacturers Association. I would like to see federal action, but the federal government hasn't acted. and the states are having to act because of that. What would you like to say now?
Sure. Oh, yeah, no.
Was it Rick?
Yeah. Oh, that was Donald.
Donald. Yeah, no, Donald is right. I have not supported federal labeling requirements for genetically modified foods for a whole series of reasons. First, research into the science, my reading of the science, causes me to believe that it's often an overhyped concern, kind of like there are a number of people who believe we shouldn't have vaccination requirements. I look at the science and I actually disagree with them. I think vaccination policy generally makes sense. And I think that whether it's following science on climate change, humans are affecting climate change, we got to do something about it, or vaccination policy, or something like genetically modified foods, I try to follow the science. And I think the science would suggest at this point, I'm not convinced that the presence of genetically modified foods is of a major public health thing that we ought to be worrying about or cause people to be worried about. And so I did not support federal GMO labeling. Part of the other reason I didn't support it is I think there's real definitional issues about what genetic modification is. Mendel's hybridization experience were genetic modification. But we have been genetically modifying plant species for generations, and it's generally been positive. So how do you draw the line to say, well, this kind of genetic modification is fine and this isn't? I think there are some major unresolved questions there. So I'm not yet a supporter federal labeling requirements for genetic modification. I don't think 90% of Virginians support that. Certainly my discussions with constituents and others about this suggest that while it is a matter that that certainly matters deeply to some, most are not so concerned about it.
Senator Tim Kaine, a visit with him along with Harry Wilson of Roanoke College and Professor Rob Roberts of James Madison University. But most of all, we thank you for your calls, your comments, and your questions. Thanks for joining in the dialogue. I'm May Lily Lee. We'll see you next time on Virginia Conversations.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.